Welcome to another episode of Critical Perspectives with Tony Macklin. In this installment, Tony and I discuss two masterful films from the 1980s, Sidney Lumet's The Verdict, starring Paul Newman, and Brian De Palma's Blowout, starring John Travolta. You can read more of Tony's views on films, both old and new, at his website at tonymacklin.net.
We doubt our institutions, and we doubt the law. But today, you are the law. You are the law. Not some book, not the lawyers, not a marble statue, or the trappings of the court. See, those are just symbols of our desire to be just. They are in fact a prayer. We have a fervent and a frightened prayer. In my religion, they say, act as if you had faith. Faith will be given to you if we are to have faith in justice. We need only to believe in ourselves.
There were a lot of important films. Like 25 years ago, it's really phenomenal that the last Emperor, Bertolucci's film, won the Oscars Best Picture. And do you remember it was up for 9 nominations, none of them in acting, and won them all. Mm-hmm. It was 9 for 9. And it's pretty much a film that is on the back burner for us.
Yeah.
And the other thing was that Mamet's first film was in 87, 25 years exactly ago, with his wife at that time, Lindsay Krauss. It was called House of Games, and it's a wonderful film.
It really is. Joe Mantegna, it is a good movie.
Yeah, and Mamet had a real feeling for women. I've never forgiven him for divorcing Lindsay Krauss, however. I love that actress, and we were going to talk about The Verdict, and Lindsay Krauss has one of the great lines in the 80s. She plays a nurse in the who's left doctoring, left nursing, left her profession because the doctors caused this woman to die and changed the records and so forth. And she's sitting, and Newman is, or they're talking to her, and Mason is, she's on the witness stand. She doesn't want to be, but she has to be. And she says, "Who are these men? Who are these men?" And I thought it was a terrific, my wife tends to say that often around the house. So that was a terrific line.
It's a heartbreaking performance. Because, I mean, she makes it clear in that kind of testimony that I wanted to be a nurse, I wanted to help people, and this is the system I was thrust into, you know. It's a very emotional performance.
It's a wonderful performance, and I think she's a wonderful actress. If you go back and look at House of Games, she really is terrific in that film. And she played in The Verdict. Do you know what other film she played in with Paul Newman?
With Paul
Newman.
This
is a curveball. This is really a curveball. Or it's really a slap shot.
Gee, let me think. She was in that too, huh? I know. she was in The Insider. She played Pacino's wife in The Insider.
I loved her very much in that. She was one of my favorite actresses of all time.
Mm, mm.
And here's another interesting thing that I found out recently. Do you watch Mad Men on television?
I've seen one or two episodes. I'm not
okay. It's kind of slackened this year, but there've been four episodes, and there's a woman, fairly young woman, who's a assistant photojournalist for Life magazine, and it's Mamet's daughter. It's David Mamet and Lindsay Krause's daughter, which is the seven separations, stages of separation. But she's now an actress. Her name is, I guess it's Sosia, because it's S-O-S-I-A. I've never really heard it pronounced. But she's a flourishing actress right today.
Oh. I was watching, what was the show I was watching? I was watching some kind of TV series, Smash.
No.
And Meryl Streep's daughter popped up in a big role in that. And you could tell, too. I mean, she has her mother's beauty.
She's an accomplished actress.
Yeah, yeah. So tell me, let's talk a little bit about Mamet then, because obviously he kind of defined to a large part the New York stage during a lot of the 70s, and then he started to get into film, and he really made a splash as a screenwriter, first and foremost. But The Verdict was pretty much, I think it's his second screenplay after The Postman Always Rings Twice.
Right.
So what do you see of his personality and his writing that's present in The Verdict?
I'm not sure I'm crazy about his personality, because he's kind of cinema's answer to Bobby Fischer. I mean, he goes to the extreme. But so much of his work is really intriguing. I mean, Spanish Prisoner is one of my favorite films, too. He has an ability. I think one of the problems is language, and when he broke on the stage, it was effing this and effing that. He showed that language like that can be a cliche, and it's very hard to pin Mamet down. Well, again, one of my favorite films. I'm not supposed to gush when I'm on the air with you, but I'm gushing today. I guess this is Friday the 13th, and if you don't gush, you get scared.
Right.
One of my favorite films is The Winslow Boy, with his second wife, Rebecca Pidgeon.
Mm-hmm.
And he had six films with her and some with Lindsay Krause. But I think the ability to see into human nature, the humanism. I mean, it's edgy, and it's unpredictable. And it's scheming, but there's a real sense. You watch any of his plays or any of his movies, and they are really enticing, really intriguing in terms of psychology, the psychological life. I mean, here, even in The Verdict, the washed up attorney Frank Galvin, the Newman part. And he's off the rails psychologically, and he has this one case that brings him back, and to see the regeneration, restoration of his life, of his very soul, as the film develops, and a lot of it is Mamet's writing, and I think he absolutely should have won the Oscar for Best Actor.
Yeah,
year
doesn't get better than Paul Newman in that movie.
Well, it does if you're going against Mahatma. Gandhi won, you know. Kingsley won for. And how do you fight that?
It's just the wrong year. They really
on one year. You've got this man of peace and this, and you, on the other hand, you've got a lawyer.
Yeah.
Who's going to win?
Well, yeah, I see your point. But, you know, there's something when you describe the movie about kind of the resurrection or the regeneration of this man who's kind of broken in spirit and everything around him shattered. That could be one particular kind of movie, and we've seen that movie many times, the kind of Rocky-esque thing where the underdog comes back, and we've seen it in Injustice for All and that big speech that everybody stands up and cheers at the end of Injustice for All. The verdict is different. I mean, the verdict, it's very kind of solemn, the tone of that movie.
Well, it's very human, and those other films are almost fairy tales. I mean, they are, as you say, you stand up and cheer. I have, unfortunately, in a movie theater, never in my life stood up and cheered. I know I'm supposed to because I read it in the ads, but it's never happened to me. But
right.
But if you remember the end of that, he succeeds professionally, and he's restored professionally, but the woman that he was in love with, or he was starting, who betrayed him, and he lets the phone ring at the end and doesn't answer it. And so it ends kind of bleakly, even though he's had this great moment professionally. Personally, he's still, in a sense, alienated. And I think that's another theme that Mamet is so good about, that keeps his work personal. The alienation that's so much a part of, I think, every film he ever did. There's this quality that came from movies of the 60s and the 70s, and he keeps it alive in almost all his work. He didn't write the novel, The Verdict, but I think he made it his own in his screenplay when he did the adaptation.
Absolutely. You know, something changed, and he admits this, something changed with Mamet after 9/11. And, I mean, he's been a bit different, but in his politics, and I guess I'm sure that showed up in his writing, too. But his next movie is the
HBO. That's why I compared him to Bobby Fischer.
Right, right.
Because, I mean, there's a wackiness now to him, and one doesn't know whether it's kind of self-indulgent or it's just to stir people up. But you're right that he has changed from a strong ultra liberal to a strong right winger, and you don't see that happen very often.
Well, his next movie is I'm really excited about, because the actor that whose work I idolize above all others is Al Pacino, and he's playing Phil Spector in David Mamet's next movie on HBO, and he made headlines, Mamet did, by saying he thinks that Spector is innocent. So that already got the buzz going about the movie. But so that's I can't wait to see that. But
the last time we talked, I told you you don't believe everything that you hear on television, and you don't believe everything that we read in the paper. We have to realize that Mamet he may have just been in his cups, or he may just have been playful, or he may actually believe it. But
I understand that, but he went into detail about how he felt that they flubbed the case, and that he was innocent, which I think is an interesting point. Does that make it a weaker film if you take a strong position and don't have some kind of ambivalence involved, that it could be one way or the other? I don't know that he does take that position in his screenplay.
Oh, I don't think so. I think as long as you're human, I think a very underrated film is Oliver Stone's Nixon. Mm. Now, he has a strong position. He almost bases it on Citizen Kane, that this is a man, Nixon was a man looking for love, as Charles Foster Kane was as well. But and he's obviously left wing. But I think the director, and especially the performance by Hopkins, makes it very memorable. Now, another film that came out where you didn't take a position, or it didn't take a position, that I think failed because of that, is the recent J. Edgar, the recent film that Clint did about Hoover.
Right.
They asked DiCaprio, now this may have been the same Mamet kind of thing, but they asked him whether he thought Hoover was gay or not. And the actor said, I don't know. I mean, how can you go into a performance? Now, he may have just been saying that for the press, but you would think that you'd have to go in at least realizing yourself. And Eastwood didn't want to make a stand. And in that case, I think it really hurt the film. I'm not saying he should have portrayed him as gay, but there was a sense, you're talking about ambivalence. There was a sense of ambivalence in the film that I think really deadened it.
I think so, too. And I mean, Eastwood is such an outstanding director, but when he hits it right, I mean, he makes great films, but when he doesn't, it's hard to invest emotionally in them because you feel that he did not invest emotionally in them when he made them. And I feel that way about J. Edgar.
Yeah.
But there are moments in it, and ironically, they're the moments that he shares with Armie Hammer in the movie, when you do feel that closeness of their relationship, and I do think that's the strongest part of the movie. It's just not defined.
Unfortunately, everybody, instead of looking at the scene, look at the makeup.
Yeah.
There was more comments about the makeup than Hammer had. Than the performance that he gave.
Right, right. So back to the verdict. I'll tell you my favorite scene in the verdict. And I think it's directorial. I mean, it might have been articulated in the script, but it's the scene where Paul Newman goes to photograph his client in the hospital with the Polaroid mm-hmm. camera. Mm-hmm. And she's, you know, covered in tubes and everything. And you can see him having an attack of conscience in that hospital room, and he sits on the bed, and you sense that he realizes at that time that he has a responsibility here, that he can't be a sellout on this one, and his conscience kind of develops as those Polaroid photos develop and show her on the bed. I think it's just a beautiful scene, no dialogue, all action, all screen direction. And it's perfectly expressed, I think, the theme of that movie and that scene.
I think the whole movie is full of things like that. And Lumet was a master director.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and he died a year ago Monday. We did a tribute to him a couple of years ago, and I reposted some interviews with actors like Chris Sarandon and some other people that we've talked to. And he was one of my favorites. And you got the sense that he cherished actors, cherished complicated situations and characters.
Well, he's written one of the best books about directing that I think any director has ever written. Sidney Lumet did.
And I guess a perfect director for really great actors to thrive. And that certainly was the case with Paul Newman.
Well, I think it's really ironic, but I think in many ways Newman was underrated. He was an underrated actor because he had these beautiful blue eyes. I remember going to a press conference where he was wearing his glasses kind of off the side of his head, and all the women, my wife included, were just spellbound by him. And I think he gave one of the great performances, one of the most underrated performances in the history of American film, in Robert Altman's Buffalo Bill and the Indians.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he was playing a character who was playing a character who was playing a character. But the seed of it is E.E. Cummings' Buffalo Bill's Defunct, the poem that he's just an image. And Newman was, in a sense, saying, here are my blue eyes, I'm a Buffalo Bill, and here's what's behind it. And I think that the picture, it was very, very unpopular. Nobody went to it because it wasn't Paul flashing his blue eyes. It was Paul saying, my blue eyes tell lies, my blue eyes deceive. And I thought it was masterly performance.
Mm-hmm.
And I also, pardon me, go ahead.
No, I think so too. And when I think about Paul Newman, a lot of his roles, he played a great rascal you know,
mm-hmm.
Mischievous rascal. But in The Verdict, it's so different. I think it's a great precursor to what he did in The Color of Money. Because in The Verdict, he's very seeped in this melancholia and this despair, and it was a different coat for him to wear in that movie.
I love to balance that with another movie that's another movie that's one of my favorites is Nobody's Fool.
Oh yeah,
I can see that in the middle. It'll be on television, and I just get every time I see it. It's so human, and Newman is so wonderful in that performance that it's one of those that. You go to an island, what movies do you take? I certainly would take that as one of my top 10 of just of films that are really about the human condition. And it's playful. I think Robert Benton directed it. It's
yeah.
Playful and yet it has Jessica Tandy. It has some good nudity as well. And it has something for everybody.
Yes. And it feels very lived in. I mean, it feels very comfortable. I do, but not lazy. I mean, that's not to say it's lazy, but it feels like you are really seeing these people in this town, that the town has life, that these characters have life to them.
They're eccentric, but they're credible. They're
yeah.
eccentric, but they're human beings, and that's what I love about it. I didn't mean to get us away from Blow Up because we got
to
talk to that.
We'll get to Blow Up, but just to kind of follow this track,
sure.
I want to talk about Newman just a little bit. When you think
sure.
of his defining performances, obviously Nobody's Fool is on that list. The Verdict. What else comes to mind for you? Buffalo Bill.
Well, the one that people probably like the most and the one that he's most famous for. Is Cool Hand Luke.
Yeah.
And I liked it, but I didn't think it had the depth of a lot of his other work. It was almost, I'm not saying a cartoon, but it was such a broad character. And he played it well. He played it so, I mean, it was lovable. And of course, you have to be lovable if you're a Christ figure, I guess. But it for me, it's a good Newman film, but not his best. And I like Somebody Up There Likes Me about Rocky Graziano.
Right, right.
At the beginning.
Well, and he hit it, I mean, Hud was one of the early successes. Talk about a rascal, talk about kind of an anti-hero.
Well, he was more than a rascal. He was an anti-hero.
Yeah, anti-hero.
He was mean spirited. I mean, he had this surface, but his father, the honorable man, wanted to kill the diseased cattle, and he wanted to make money off them, and so there was nothing. I don't think there was anything redeeming about that character, except to maybe. In the book, the Patricia Neal role is a black woman, an African American, and in the movie they changed it. But I think what he did in that film was almost the blue eyes were wonderful, but there was a lot of corruption and conniving behind them. It's a very good performance.
I think it is too, and it doesn't kind of make excuses for that character. I mean that it was a brave portrayal, especially at that time. I think.
I think he gave a lot of brave portrayals. I really do think that Newman I think he's certainly one of the great actors in American film history, and he's. Thought of almost more as a superstar. I think if you compare him to Robert Redford, for instance, Robert Redford let stardom go to his head. And I don't think Newman ever did.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think Newman, in fact, fought against it. I mean, he knew that
yeah.
that it was what got people in the theater, and he knew that he had to smile and be in and enthrall the women and so forth. But he also had a spirit that wouldn't let him. I don't think he sold out ever. I mean, everybody has to make some, all of these actors have to make some films that they really are not crazy about making. But I think there's an integrity to Newman's work.
Well, I remember hearing him tell a story, and I just rewatched The Color of Money just last night, and I remember him telling a story about working with Scorsese, and he was doing a take, and he finished the take, and Scorsese would stop the camera, and then Scorsese would start dancing around, and then he'd say, okay, do another one. And he did that two or three times. And eventually Paul Newman was like, what the hell are you doing? What the heck are you trying to tell me? And Scorsese says, you're trying too hard. Dude, don't do anything. And I thought that was such a surprising note for a director to have to give to Newman, because looking at something like The Verdict, I mean, it's so kind of minimally, not at all forcefully done, that performance.
I think he comes to that role with a lot of baggage. He was the hustler. He was Fast Eddie.
Yeah.
And this is Fast Eddie brought back. The Color of Money, directed by Marty Scorsese. So there's a lot of reason to step up and strain and be. Has Fast Eddie lost it? Has Newman lost it? Ironically, it's the film that won him an Oscar.
Yeah.
That he won the acting Oscar for that role. But that's very interesting. It's also a film that the more you see it, the more you like it. At least it's a film I'll just speak for myself. The more I see it, the first time I saw it, I said, oh, it's good, but I think it's better than good. I think it has a lasting resonance.
I think so too. It deepens for me too, and I think the first time you watch it, it feels kind of anticlimactic, because it doesn't quite end up the way you think it will, but you see the nuances in it the more you watch it, and the contrast between he and Cruz, and what he sees in Cruz, that reminds him of him at that age.
Here's another thing in my one day of affirmation in the month. It's all coming today. I think Cruz is an underrated actor.
I think so too.
And I don't quite understand it. I know he's been foolish in public, and I know he's a fairly short man, and I know the Scientology. But I just buy. I think he gets a lot out of action heroes, and he, like in this, the relationship, he really did have a chemistry with Newman.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that that Newman's performance was certainly enhanced by Cruise's.
Well, I think Tom Cruise is kind of defined by, at least the for the most part of his career before he went crazy, I think it was defined by he gravitated towards people that he could learn a lot from. He worked with only the best people that raised his game an enormous amount. I mean, you look at his collaborations throughout his career, and they're jaw-dropping.
Mm-hmm.
I think that made him a very good, special actor. I agree with you.
When you say he was crazy, but he's crazy like a fox in many ways.
Right.
Because he was... I think we have to separate his artistry or his talent. I'm not sure that we can mention many roles where there was a phoniness or an artificiality that Cruise does bring what he has. He does invest it in his work.
Oh, I absolutely agree, and I love Tom Cruise. I just use When He Went Crazy to kind of encapsulate that whole period of time.
Right, right.
Yeah.
The Oprah moment, yeah.
Yeah, and I can always separate the two. As long the work is what matters to me, because that's the only thing that matters that he gives to me. I don't know the man, so
right.
Why should I hold a grudge against those?
And you're taller than he is, so, you know.
slightly, yeah, so I feel confident in that respect, too.
It began with a sound that no one was ever supposed to hear.
Yes, he says he pulled the girl out of the car.
And I would like you to forget about her.
Yeah, that's what I heard just before the tire blew out. You're right, it was a shot.
He recorded a murder. They say it never happened.
There's still loose ends. Witnesses. The girl... I've decided to terminate her. Terminate her. Terminate her.
De Palma's blowout. Now you hear it. Now you don't.
So let's talk about blowout. I want to know, first of all, what your general feeling is of De Palma.
Initially, I thought he was kind of the bastard child of Hitchcock and Lizzie Borden. He tended to use a lot of Hitchcock and in fact, use it too much. And, of course, there's the gore and grizzle and big effects. But in Blow Up, I think it's a beautiful film. I think it is really almost, I don't want to say perfect, but he in Blow Up... That was a film where it really was personal. I mean, he grew up in New Jersey, so he knows the Philadelphia area. He's making major statements about technology, major statements about reality and illusion, appearance and reality, major statements about American, its history and its values, and he's on the edge in blow-ups in so many scenes. Like that culmination when Jack is holding Sally and the fireworks go off behind, you say, that can't work. It's so corny. It's like Something Came Running when Sinatra held Shirley MacLaine, Ginny character. But it works. And the end of that film is just stunning. I think the film, two films that I've left the theater almost stricken are Blow Up. I mean, I was exhilarated by it, but it is so bleak and hopeless at the end. And the other one being Bonnie and Clyde, where the whole audience left and there wasn't a word spoken. It was a crowded theater, and then at the end of Bonnie and Clyde, people don't see it in the theater anymore. They see it on television, where it really doesn't have the same impact. But those two films left me stricken. Now, my favorite film is Blowout. I like Untouchables. I certainly respect Serpico. Scarface. Pardon me, Scarface. But I don't exactly go into the theater with the Palma film saying, I trust what I'm going to see on the screen. But in Blowout, I just thought it was his absolute moment of truth.
Mm. I'm crazy about De Palma. And we've done a lot of tribute shows to him, and we had him on, and we've talked to a lot of people that worked with him. But Blowout is my favorite movie. I'm just like you. And I feel that it's a summation of a lot of stuff that he was working towards. And what's not pointed out a lot about De Palma's films is how political they are because of the genre he tends to work in. But I really see Blowout as kind of like the last of those great political conspiracy movies of the 70s. It just came out in 1981. It feels of that ilk to me.
Yeah, it was conspiracy, but I think part of it is Chappaquiddick, and part of it is certainly Nixon and Watergate. But to me, so many films that are conspiracy, and we talk about conspiracy, are not art. And to me, that this conspiracy, I think, is only a small part of it. What is so much bigger for me personally is the idea of liberty and what's happened to liberty. I know you can say that's conspiracy, but to me that's only one corner of it. The John Lithgow, terrible villain, is called the Liberty Bell Strangler, and he's wearing a button that says "I love liberty," and the film is. Sometime watch it and watch how often he uses red, white, and blue.
Right.
He had two wonderful photographers. He had Vilmos Zsigmond. And then the Liberty Day parade, the footage was stolen. And Zsigmond wasn't available. So he was able to use the other Hungarian director who had come to this country with Zsigmond, Laszlo Kovács.
Yeah.
He used him to reshoot the scene, and there is so much symbolism that deals with America and the loss of values, and I think conspiracy makes it almost pigeonhole.
Yeah, it makes it sound trivial. But when I said that, what makes it a great film of that type of genre is that it finds the depths of meaning within that conspiracy. It's more than a plot device. It's expressing something especially about that era where we enter the Reagan era, and there's a certain image in politics that we can't trust, but it's comforting. We want to buy into it. And I think that the ultimate what makes that the ending of that film so haunting is that Travolta gives up. You know.
What makes it so haunting is that we've had appearance and reality, and here the appearance is the reality. It's an actual scream. I mean, it's just a shocking and incredible moment on the screen.
And she dies in front of an American flag. I mean, you can't.
Yeah, oh no, the film is just full of that. I know Wanamaker's department store, and when Jack is speeding towards Penn's Landing, also I've been at the 30th Street Station, which Zsigmond photographs beautifully. When I used to go to basketball games all the time in Palestra, I would be in there. I've lived along the Schuylkill Expressway, which in Philadelphia is called the Schuylkill Expressway, where the car goes off into the river. Mm. But when he goes into when he crashes into the window of Wanamaker's, this is just one small scene. He crashes in. And there's a in honor of the Liberty Day Jubilee or whatever it's called, which there isn't, of course, it's fictional. But there is a patriot, and there's a noose in the exhibit in the window, and then he's hurt. Jack Terry is hurt. He's taken to an ambulance. And he's got a bandage on that makes him look like a drummer boy or something. He looks like he's been in the Civil War, Revolutionary War, and he tears it off and then runs desperately to try and save Sally. But that the film is just full of those moments of history, and they're compelling, and
even in that 4th of July celebration, I mean the fireworks and the crowd's cheers and all of that stuff, the celebratory nature of it is so heightened that it blocks out her screams. And even that can be taken as metaphorical.
Oh, that's beautiful. I mean, that is symbolic. I agree.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
And then there's the idea of the wire. The wire is a murder weapon. It's the strangler. And the wire is technology. He has the tape, but the tape is gone. And there's De Palma shoots it almost like the conversation, Coppola's film, at one point when we see loss and waste and technology has not answered. Technology has failed us because Jack has initially caused the death of another agent because of the wire didn't work. And so he's haunted by his past and the country's past, and it's just an extremely complete and fulfilling motion picture for me.
Well, De Palma, I mean, he took when he devised Blowout, he took Antonioni's Blow Up and The Conversation. Those were his two points of inspiration, and he did something completely unique and infused it with some deep sense of where we were at that time. But I think that's where he's best. He copies from Hitchcock quite a bit, but when he really works, what does he do with Hitchcock? Where does he take it? And when he's at his best, he takes it to another level.
There's a scene that's absolutely Hitchcockian, and yet it's one of my favorite images in the film. I shouldn't say favorite, but it really is. When the woman goes into the prostitute goes into the bathroom in 30th Street Station, and Lithgow, the killer, goes in next to her, the stall next to her, and then we see her shoes, her red shoes, dangling and twisting, and you know that he's hung her. I mean, it doesn't have to say a thing. It's absolutely Hitchcockian, but it's Hitchcockian. You were saying about people accuse him of copying. I think almost every director who deals in any kind of suspense or any kind of effectiveness probably is influenced a little bit by Hitchcock, some more than others. When he uses the Hitchcockian, I think that he just uses it. He doesn't, at his worst, it doesn't have his originality, or maybe creativity is a better word. It doesn't have his creativity. And a lot of critics, it's easy to say, he's just another Hitchcock, because a lot of times he paid obeisance to Hitch. But you're right that when he makes it his own, as a good director does, and as a sometimes great director does, it becomes personal and individual and unique.
Yeah. I also like his visual flair, and that he almost, in a lot of his movies, you get the sense where that he wishes that he could get past all the scenes of people talking so he could just tell the story with his camera, which is what a filmmaker is. I mean, that's essentially he's such a master of the visual language. I want to talk to you, though, about two more things concerning Blowout, and one of them is Travolta. I mean, this is known as one of Travolta's great overlooked performances, and a lot of people say one of his first adult performances.
Yeah, I think he's ideal. I mean, I don't have – there's not a moment when he changes. At the beginning, he's an exploitation photographer. I don't mean sound man. He's for an exploitation company that makes – horror movies or sex movies or whatever. And his beginning to care about the truth when the whole society doesn't care about it, he makes it believable. I think that he's been in so many films and he has been knocked around, but to me that I was talking about the integrity of an actor. There he seems to hit it perfectly. There's a growth or a change or an evolution, but there's also we never can stop identifying with him because he's after the truth. They say somebody says one of the politicians says you can't tell it, and he says, but that's the truth, and we see where the truth leads him. The truth leads him at the end to futility. But
yeah.
I think that I can't think of a better actor, of a better performance, but of an actor giving a better performance. And I think Sally was good. Here's another example. Like, Mamet always married his actresses, or they acted. And he was married. De Palma was married to Nancy Allen when they made this film.
Right.
That makes it personal, too. I mean, there's a...
I think so, too, but it was funny because we brought on Nancy Allen to talk about Blowout, actually, and I'd never heard her say, I'd never heard her say this in public. But De Palma's criticized for a lot of things, but one of them is that he's a misogynist.
Right.
And so I asked her about that, and she shocked me. She said, well, he is. Oh my gosh! Okay, so that was completely unexpected. But
that doesn't mean he may be a misogynist, but that doesn't mean that he can't find the truth and reality in the female actors, female characters. I mean, certainly there are. He's a male oriented, but I think he really understands Sally so much,
yeah,
and probably understands his wife, although nobody understands her wife. I think there's that he is a misogynist, but that doesn't mean that there's not an ability to perceive the feminine spirit.
Yeah, and I think the genre that he worked in most, it was kind of a great ground to explore misogyny in a way. And then another genre, the war film, his Casualties of War.
Right.
There's so many kind of haunting moments in that movie. It really feels like the supreme violation. When you see images of that girl on the tracks before she's shot and killed,
right?
Oh my gosh, it's powerful. I just love De Palma, but also the element in the film in Blowout, the kind of the love of filmmaking, and how that's articulated by his retracing through the sound, the photos, the whole conspiracy with the actual blowout. There's a lot
but
of
what's interesting
there.
is that it's balanced the love of filmmaking and the love of technology, but also the failure of technology. That technology so often doesn't deliver or winds up spinning out of control. I think this is an auteur making a film and really involving himself in the very making of the film.
Mm-hmm.
So, I would agree with you that there's a film, but it's also the limitations of perception. Mm-hmm. That just because we read something or we hear something or the Philadelphia Daily News calls him the Liberty Bell Strangler, he's a serial killer. Well, he's not a serial killer. He's a cold-blooded psychopath who's got a job to do, who thinks he has a job to do. But everything, so much of it is misleading. They, like the and it's interesting to watch this in concert with Blow Up, where there's the sense of, there's a, the appearance of things, but the filmmaker is constantly trying to get at the reality of things. Sometimes does, sometimes doesn't, sometimes can't. You don't sound like you believe that.
No, I absolutely do, and that's what we were discussing, the kind of image of what we're sold, that image kind of comforts us in a way, keeps us at a distance, but it hides what's really going on, and that search for the truth, and at the end of the film, he can't do it anymore. And you want to believe in Travolta so much. I think that's what's great about Travolta in the movie. I mean, he's a guy that you can believe in. And when he gives up, at the end, it's heartbreaking. It's really, I just adore that.
Well, we are hoping so fervently that he's going to arrive in time, and maybe he has, that he's going to save her, that we're not only going to be satisfied, we're going to be fulfilled, because it has worked out. It has satisfied our needs. And when Travolta is destroyed, we are certainly set back in the audience. And that scream at the end, irony, and one of the things I like best in film, and one of the things that I think is probably disappearing from film today when you go back to the 80s and 70s and the 60s, is the great sense of irony. That this is an ironic film, as so many of the films of that 30-year period were. That the Rafelson films were absolutely full of irony. That Jack Nicholson was the embodiment of irony. And that Blow Up has this, I can't think of a more ironic ending than the great explosion of pyrotechnics and fireworks and the demise, the absolute forlorn futility of what's happened to Sally.
And the 80s, and this was another point that I've heard brought up in previous years talking about this movie, the 80s being kind of a decade defined by consumerism, and that film, you know, this very real scream of death, and it's in the service of a great Z horror film at the end.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think I told you before, I don't know whether I did, about teaching The Graduate or being with audiences when The Graduate came out in 67, and everybody cheered and thought that Benjamin, and I taught it during the 80s, and the students said, yeah, but where are their things? What are they going to do? Where are their things? And I also used the word, how many of you are anti-establishment? Nobody was in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And so Jack still is. Jack Terry still is.
Yeah. And that came at 81. That's why I think it's such a prescient political movie. I mean, it came at the very beginning of that decade, and it saw where we were going, where we were. It's a great movie. I feel like I could cry. I love that movie so much. So what have you, before I let you go, what have you seen lately that has you been struck by? Anything?
Yeah, House of Games from from 87 and Blowout from 81. I have two pictures that I like a lot. A Game Change, which was on HBO.
Yeah.
And I'm a Hunger Games guy. I thought that Ross did a really good job in making a commercial motion picture.
Mm-hmm.
I think you read my review on Goon. I liked Goon because I was just astounded by Scott's performance. I didn't know he was that kind of an actor.
Mm-hmm.
He had that quality. One thing I want to add to our discussion here is that the 87 was the first film that Mamet directed, and it also was the year of the last film that came out posthumously after the death of John Huston, The Dead, which is based on James Joyce's short story with his daughter Angelica. And so 87, there was a gain and a loss that I wanted to at least mention.
I remember being in art school and our teacher showing us The Dead. That's John.
But did anybody in that class like it?
Probably not. I mean,
It was a really interesting experience for me, because when I taught it, it's one of the films that was most hated that I ever taught. There was one Irish girl who said at the end of the term, "That's the best film we've seen this year."
Mm.
It just reached her. There was something about the experience, but it's a tough, hard film. But I don't think it's a failure. I think it just is so different, and so we have to really change our gears to get into it. We have to. But it's. But he was a great director who passed 25 years ago.
And I don't know that, and I haven't watched that movie since then. This was probably 90. I saw it. So I need to revisit it, but I don't know that it was we were at a point in our lives where we could appreciate the themes swirling around in that film necessarily.
Probably not, and you really do have to get into its wavelength. But then when you see the snow at the end and you know that John Huston is on oxygen dying when he's making this film, it's like Soylent Green when Edward G. Robinson was dying and he had a scene in the film where he was dying. There is something really.
There's a feeling of finality. Yeah. Yeah.
It makes it. It's not just the scene, but it makes it film is life and life is film.